The second reading is taken from Mark's Gospel. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the Praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him. They twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. Falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. Then they led him out to crucify him. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way in from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross. They brought Jesus to the place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it. And they crucified him. Dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. It was the third hour when they crucified him. The written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews." They crucified two robbers with him, one on his right and one on his left. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down from the cross, that we may see and believe." Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him.
David, thank you for reading. Let me add my welcome to you. My name is Simon Dowdy. I'm the vicar here at St. Botolph's, and it's very good to have you with us for our Easter service. Now, this is how one writer describes crucifixion. After passing of the sentence, the Roman soldiers had unlimited opportunity to torture the prisoners, both in the preliminary beatings and in the freedom to choose the method of impaling the victim. There was no uniform method. Victims might have been impaled through their eyes, genitals, hands or feet, with their bodies hanging in a variety of positions. Crucifixion was death by exhaustion. Victims sometimes took days to die. The agony is reflected, isn't it, in our word, excruciating. Now, what is so striking about Mark's account of the crucifixion of Jesus, which he just had read for us, is that in common with all the other gospel writers, he doesn't dwell on the physical details of crucifixion. No doubt, in partly because his readers and listeners would have been all too familiar with the details. The very word crucifixion would have inspired a deep emotion in the first century. But the primary reason is because the significance of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ lies elsewhere. Crucifixion was common in the first century. We're told, aren't we, that two robbers were crucified alongside Jesus. So the fact of crucifixion itself was not unique. Rather, there are a number of specific things which Mark draws our attention to, which do explain the unique significance of Jesus' crucifixion. Because in common with all the gospel writers, Mark is not simply interested in recording events of history, although of course he does do that. These are real events we are reading about. But more than that, he is wanting to show us the significance of those events. And it's here that he gets to the very heart of that first Good Friday. Notice two things. First of all, notice how Jesus is proclaimed as God's King. Jesus is proclaimed as God's King. Early that first Good Friday morning, the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem had brought Jesus in front of the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate. They wanted him dead, but they knew that only the Roman authorities had the power to pass a sentence which was going to lead to capital punishment. So they bring him before the Roman authorities, accused of what they knew in the Roman eyes would be a treasonable offence, that he claimed to be their king. And it was true. Jesus had claimed to be a king, but a king of far greater significance than Pontius Pilate understood. Because Jesus hadn't claimed simply to be another worldly ruler, a worldly king, but he had claimed to be God, to be God's king, and therefore to have the right to be king over everyone in his world, because he is Lord and King of all. He'd backed that up by his miracles. Mark's Gospel records eyewitness accounts of many of them. They are hard to ignore. They show that not only did Jesus claim to be God, claim to be God's King, he then demonstrated it in the miracles that he did. He did what only God can do. So the sentence is passed and Jesus is led away to be flogged, where notice again Mark portrays the soldiers as unwittingly mocking Jesus, but doing so unwittingly as God's king. So they wrap a purple robe around him, the same colour that would have been worn by the Roman emperor. They put a mock crown of thorns on his head. They hail him King of the Jews, a deliberate echo of Hail Caesar. They fall at his knees, pretending to pay homage to him. You see, Mark's focus is on the fact that here is God's king being crucified. And the charge that is fastened to the cross even proclaims, doesn't it, King of the Jews. Now, I guess there are bound to be some of us here this lunchtime, and we have yet to make up our minds about Jesus and about who he is. If that is you, then Mark points us back to that first Good Friday. It is there when Jesus, humanly speaking, looked weak and defeated, that actually he is demonstrating for all to see that he is indeed God's Lord and King. In a previous church I was at, we interviewed people in the local park one Saturday morning, and we asked them what they made of Jesus. And a number of people said something like this, that Jesus was a kind of revolutionary religious figure, that his campaign went badly wrong, that he was rejected by his own people, and therefore resigned himself to his fate of crucifixion. But can we see that couldn't be further from the truth? It's not that Jesus sort of gradually came to realize that his whole mission had been a failure, and that he gradually kind of resigns himself to the fact that he would be rejected and killed, and so kind of decides to make the best of a bad job in the way in which he does die. No, it is that he is God's king. After all, he had predicted three times the details of how he would suffer and die. This is what he said of himself. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. What's more, crucifixion is exactly what God had said back in the Old Testament would happen when his king came to earth. Wasn't that reading from Psalm 22 extraordinary? Written hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus by King David, the greatest of Old Testament kings, yet speaking so clearly of crucifixion. Let me read part of Psalm 22 again. I am poured out like water. All my bones are out of joint. My heart has turned to wax. It has melted away within me. My strength is dried up. My tongue sticks to the roof of my mouth. You lay me in the dust of death. Dogs have surrounded me. A band of evil men has encircled me. They have pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. People stare and gloat over me. They divide my garments among them and cast lots for my clothing. It is just what happened to Jesus. Can we see at the very moment when Jesus looks defeated, we see that actually everything that Jesus said about his death during his lifetime, everything the Old Testament said about what would happen when God's King came, those things are fulfilled. That is the first thing I want us to notice, that Jesus is proclaimed God's King. But secondly, will you notice that Jesus is the King who dies in the place of others? Jesus Christ is the King who dies in the place of others. Have a look again, take up that reading and look at the penultimate paragraph there, verses 29 to 30, and just see what the crowds say. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So, you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." Do you get the gist of what the crowd are saying as they taunt Jesus? Here is the man who made such staggering claims. He claimed to be God in the flesh. He's done miracles that no one at the time was able to dispute. Yet he's being crucified. Now the crowd thinks to themselves, this guy is obviously a fraud. He cannot even save himself. If he really is the Christ, if he really is God's King, then he'll come down from the cross. Well, it's compelling logic, isn't it? But of course the point is that Jesus could have done that. The reason he doesn't is explained at the beginning of the next paragraph. In the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. He saved others, they said, but he can't save himself. Let this Christ, this King of Israel, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe. Those crucified with him also heaped insults on him. Now the irony is they're right. Jesus could have saved himself, or he could have saved others. But he couldn't do both. You see, they imagine, don't they, that if Jesus at that moment had come down from the cross, that they would have believed. But actually one of the striking things is, as you read through Mark's Gospel, is that people weren't persuaded by Jesus' miracles. Now, unlike today when people doubt the miracles actually happened, people back in the first century, they couldn't do that because they saw the miracles before their eyes. Instead, they doubted the source of Jesus' power. They said, this man is demonic. He's satanic. I wonder if you've ever heard people say something like this, or perhaps you may have thought it yourself. I believe in God if only he would prove his existence to me. If only he kind of gave me some kind of sign which would put his existence beyond doubt, some kind of dramatic sign that I could see with my eyes. It's kind of hard to argue with that, isn't it? But the evidence of the New Testament suggests that we wouldn't believe. After all, those who actually saw Jesus on earth and saw his miracles, so often they weren't persuaded. And so we wouldn't be persuaded today. Besides, 3 days later, there was a far greater miracle than Jesus coming down from the cross. That is that he rose from the grave, never to die again. It may be that some of us this lunchtime are thinking, well, I long for a sign, some kind of miracle that would show to me that God exists. In which case, look at the resurrection and the proof for the resurrection of Jesus from the dead, never to die again. So you see, it's not that Jesus was unable to come down from the cross. It's that he couldn't do that and save others. That is why he came. Not to start a revolution, not to be a social worker, not to fulfill my every need, but to save others. It's why in the next few verses, Jesus cries out as he is crucified, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Because you see, here lies the heart of that first Good Friday, that Jesus Christ was forsaken by God as he was crucified. He was forsaken by God so that we needn't be. Let me say that again. Jesus was forsaken by God so that we needn't be. Now, I don't need to convince you that you are not naturally right with God. Left to our own devices, none of us are naturally right with God. We may be religious, or this may be the very first time we've been in a church building, but all of us, by nature, live for ourselves and not for God. Consciously or unconsciously, all of us keep God at the very edge of our lives. We are very much the ones, aren't we, who are in the driving seat. But wonderfully, Jesus died in our place so that we might be forgiven. He saved others, but he cannot save himself. If in a few minutes you go outside into Postman's Park, the main feature in the park is the Watts Memorial. You may well have seen it just as you go out of that exit there. A memorial that was built to commemorate the Silver Jubilee of Queen Victoria. And it's a memorial of heroic self-sacrifice. And it lists countless ordinary people who gave their lives to save others. So Alfred Smith, a police constable who was killed in an air raid while saving the lives of women and young girls, June the 13th, 1917. Joseph Andrew Ford, aged 30, who saved six people from a fire in the Gray's Inn Road, but was scorched to death himself, October the 7th, 1871. Well, Jesus Christ, God's King, died in the place of others, in our place, so that we might be able to stand before God forgiven on the final judgment day as his people. He was forsaken by God so that we needn't be. Now, it doesn't mean that forgiveness is then automatic. It's why throughout the Gospels, Jesus is always calling people to follow him, to trust in him. But for those who do follow him, for those who do trust in him, why, we can have real confidence that we are forgiven now and on the final judgment day we'll be able to stand before God as a forgiven person. Now let me finish by addressing the two types of people who I imagine are here this lunchtime. First of all, for those for whom this is all new, or perhaps you're someone, as you hear this, you just think to yourself, well, frankly, I'm uncertain about where I stand before God. I'm uncertain about whether I'm forgiven or not. Well, why not read through Mark's accounts of Jesus' life over Easter? It only takes a couple of hours to read it through. Alternatively, I'd love to give you one of these little booklets called The Real Jesus, which just goes over again some of the things we've been thinking about this lunchtime. There's also a course that we run here at St. Botolph's, in, like many other churches up and down the country, called Christianity Explored. And you'll see there's more information on the back of the service sheet about that. The next course starts on April the 19th. I know a number here have done it already, and it's an excellent course. But then for those who are following Jesus already and are trusting in Jesus already, but again, will you read through one of the Gospels again over Easter? Will you marvel that here is God's King come to earth, fulfilling everything that was written about him, even to death? Will you wonder that he didn't save himself so that he could save you? And will you give yourself again to following such a wonderful Saviour?